Welcome to Footnotes, a podcast by the Sydney University Law Society, sponsored by Gilbert and Tobin. My name's Alana, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, we're looking into Australia's defamation laws, how they've led to multi-million dollar celebrity disputes, and how they're all about to change. We also speak to David Rolfe, a professor here at the Sydney University Law School and leading expert on the modernisation of defamation law.
So I think there's a sort of lively defamation culture in Australia, particularly in New South Wales, which is really the sort of epicentre of all of this. At the moment, we're in the process of trying to change that, but how effective that will be, I think, is something of an open question.
So before you spill the tea or dive into your next USID rants, definitely give this episode a listen. Before we get into it, I just want to note that this episode contains discussions of sexual assault cases. Okay, here's the episode. So to kick things off, I'm joined by Vivian, who's going to help debunk what is defamation. So when a person's been defamed, it means their reputation has been tarnished in some way because of what someone said. And so whether something's defamatory can depend a lot on who said it and in what context. Vivian, did you know what defamation was before starting this podcast?
Yeah, not really, to be honest. I thought defamation was just like ruining someone's reputation, which I guess is kind of what it is. But I think there's so many little technical elements to it. And I had no idea, for example, that defamation trials actually include a jury, which is something that I thought was just exclusive to the criminal trial sphere.
Oh, totally. It's just one of the ways that defamation is this really wacky, unique sort of law. So we'll try and break it down, because one of the things that I always thought was that defamation was just against news outlets, because historically defamation has been a newspaper saying something nasty or untrue about someone that's in the public eye. But you're right, defamation's so much broader than that. It can be in any form, so it's print, radio, television, but also over email and social media, which we'll definitely discuss in this episode. And yeah, it can affect everyone because everyone has a reputation, whether it's in a business context, with their friends, or as part of your job as a politician or actor or influencer. So companies can't sue for defamation, really, because they've got other ways to challenge something that might damage their brand reputation. And our defamation laws are mainly looking at the personal aspect of it. And so the laws that we have started in 2005, we had our uniform defamation laws, which were to fix up this real hodgepodge of legislation across the different states. Mm-hmm. So now in New South Wales, we have our aptly titled Defamation Act. But putting things in perspective, our uniform defamation laws came in 2005, and that was when Facebook was just getting started, Twitter was a year away, Instagram was 5 years away, and it was 11 years before TikTok. So in 2018, they had a statutory review and they came up with the Defamation Amendment Act, which New South Wales passed in August 2020. But it hasn't come into play just yet. They haven't even picked a commencement date. So there's still a lot of unknowns, but there are things that we do know, which is that, yeah, the tort of defamation sits in a category all on its own and looks pretty different. So Vivian, talk me through, what does a plaintiff have to prove to win a defamation trial?
So there are three elements that a plaintiff needs to prove. First one being publication, and that publication needs to also identify either directly or indirectly the individual, and also that publication needs to have a defamatory meaning, and that's to the ordinary reasonable person. So what defamatory actually means is that the publication caused someone to be shunned, shamed, or avoided by others, or that their reputation was adversely impacted in some kind of way in the minds of right-thinking members of society. So that's when the jury comes in as the people who kind of determine what the standard of defamatory actually means. And the idea behind that is because juries probably have a better internal compass than judges when it comes to what is considered defamatory. And when we interviewed Professor David Rolfe, he mentioned this anecdote about this woman who sued a comedian. And because it was a judge-only trial, the judge then went on some super long reasoning as to why, although him as a superior intellectual kind of understood that a comedian's words should be only taken lightly, he thought that ordinary members of society kind of wouldn't realize that this comedian was only joking. And so maybe that's a little bit tilted in favor of plaintiffs.
And that's why I think you can elect, like you can choose as a party whether you want to have a jury or not.
And another reason why juries are good is because they don't need to give reasoning, unlike judges, because it should be intuitive, right? Like what is considered defamatory and what isn't.
I guess the next unique part about defamation law is the defenses.
Yeah, there's actually 9 defenses. We won't go into them in detail because it's super technical, but pretty much you can divide them into 3 categories. And the first one being truth. So for example, if the plaintiff has said that, you know, this media corporation kind of said something mean about me, the media corporation can then argue that what they said was actually substantially true. So when this defense is raised, you kind of get this trialception thing happening where there's a trial within a trial, because then the defendant needs to actually prove that what they said was true or is based on evidence and facts. And the second defense is honest opinion, where the media outlet or where the defendant can then try establish that it was an expression of opinion rather than statement of fact. And it related to matter of public interest and was based on proper material. The third defense is quite interesting. It's either absolute privilege, which includes proceedings in parliament or in court and tribunals, and qualified privilege, which is typically raised by journalists when they say that they had a duty to report on their subject matter. So there's the idea of the public good and how it should override the protection of someone's individual interest, because as a journalist, they have a duty to inform the public about what is important, and even if it's unsavory to that individual themselves. There's another category also that sits on its own. It's for internet service providers in particular, and they get their own exception for transmitting information that could be defamatory. But then kind of things like get more complicated for search engines like Google, but we'll get to that later in the episode.
What you were saying about qualified privilege, I think really brings it to the crux of the issue here, where you're trying to balance freedom of expression with personal reputation and their rights to protect that. And you can definitely see that there could be this chilling impact on public interest journalism, and you get all these wealthy individuals trying to slam all the news corporations for saying things that they don't like.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like one principle has to give way for the other, right? Australia doesn't have a Bill of Rights. We don't have an enshrined freedom of speech in our legislation. And although I initially thought it was really important, David Rolfe gave us his insight on why he thinks we actually don't need one.
Freedom of speech is sort of fairly poorly understood, people point out, about the implied freedom of political communication, with the suggestion that there's no freedom of speech beyond that, which is not entirely true, because of course somewhere like Australia sort of adopts the sort of common law model that you're free to say whatever you like unless you defame someone, infringe copyright, breach confidence, you know, commit contempt. So it's true. I mean, it's true that speech in Australia is free. It's presumptively free. It's just when you know something about the constraints that are imposed by all of those sort of areas of law, substantive areas of law, then, you know, the actual freedom that one experiences is somewhat constrained. So look, that's why you've got places like the United Kingdom, which initially proceeded on the basis of that, Canada, New Zealand, all of those have enshrined in some way at a national level a right to freedom of speech. Of course, Queensland, Victoria and the ACT have enshrined that as well, and that seems to have had precisely zero effect on defamation law. To a certain extent, I'm a sort of rights agnostic. It won't hurt, but I'm not sure how much it will change things.
We also asked David Rolfe what he finds most interesting about defamation law.
The thing that I quite liked about it, and still like about it, is that it's intellectually difficult. So the law is, in many instances, sort of incomprehensible, you know, but coupled with, you know, the underlying material, you know, where else would you be able to sort of meditate upon important questions like, is it defamatory to say of someone that they are akin to the devil? Or is it defamatory to say of a man that he has a small penis? Or, you know, all these sorts of, you know, profound sort of questions that people sue about. Although there are, can be very serious defamation cases where people clearly have to take proceedings. in many instances, people don't have to take proceedings and would be well advised not to take proceedings and nevertheless do take proceedings. In those sort of situations where you're really dealing with sort of ego and people's sensitivities and things like that, their sort of pride, all those sorts of their vanity, where you're dealing with those sorts of things, it's really an area of law to a certain extent where people don't get hurt in the same way that they do in family law or criminal law, where you're dealing with much more profound sort of, or even, you know, the serious tort claims. Whereas many of the sorts of harms in defamation are comparatively ephemeral. I mean, there are very many instances where you obviously have to sue. So if someone's going to accuse you of being a funder of terrorism or something like that, you're going to have to sue. But there are a lot of things where you sort of come across this sort of case and you go, look, if somebody wrote that about me and published that on the front page of a newspaper, you'd get a bottle of your favourite alcohol, a box of Lindt chocolates, box of tissues, crawl into bed, pull the eiderdown over your head, cry a bit, eat chocolates, drink, and hope that sort of, you know, a few days later, Trump supporters have stormed the Capitol, taking everything off the front page and, you know, there's some other front page story. I mean, these sorts of things pass.
So let's take a look at some of the prominent defamation cases that you probably would have heard of over the past few years. For this section, I'm joined by Vivian.
Hey!
So New South Wales has been deemed the defamation capital of the world, with more than half of Australia's defamation cases being brought in our state.
And this says a lot because over these past 5 years, defamation law issues were considered by courts in Sydney 10 times more frequently than anywhere else in the world, including other major cities like London.
Which has led to some really high-profile cases, which we'll dive into now.
One recent high-profile case is the actor Jeffrey Rush's defamation case, which currently holds the record for the largest defamation payout to a single person in Australia. The Daily Telegraph agreed to pay almost $2 million for Rush's lost earnings, as well as an $850,000 payout for a series of reports accusing him of inappropriate behaviour towards a female actor during the Sydney Theatre Company production of King Lear. Another big case was Rebel Wilson's defamation action, which received a lot of attention for the amount of damages initially awarded and then later reduced by the Victorian Court of Appeal. Although $4.7 million in compensation was ordered at first, Rebel actually had to return $4.1 million of these damages, as well as pay 80% of Bauer's legal costs.
Ouch. So if those are the big numbers, what were the facts that gave rise to this?
Yep, so articles in some of Bauer Media's tabloid women's magazines, you know the ones, said that Rebel lied about her age, childhood, and even her real name. And she claims that this meant she didn't receive any leading roles, even after she had starred in big blockbuster films like Pitch Perfect, due to the grapevine effect.
So if you've got actors with global careers, you know, their producers are in Hollywood, why are they bringing their claims here in Australia?
So cases like these have popped up here largely because of the plaintiff-friendly model of our defamation laws here in Australia. If Rebel Wilson had run her case in America against American media outlets, it actually would have been much harder for her to get the outcome she wanted. Libel is the term you'll hear a lot in relation to the US, which usually describes written defamation as opposed to slander, which is verbal. Our Defamation Act abolished the difference between the two, which means here, defamation in any form is still just defamation. Okay, back to the US. They have a pretty high threshold for libel, which requires that a plaintiff has to prove that the defamatory material was actually false. And if the plaintiff is a public figure, they also have to show that the material was published with actual malice and a reckless disregard for the truth.
That seems like a pretty high bar.
It definitely is, which makes sense in the US because it essentially aligns with their First Amendment right to the freedom of speech.
Obviously, these two cases were quite popular in the media at the time, but we asked David Rolfe if he has a favourite defamation case.
So there's an unreported case. It was reported in the Times back in 1954, and Justice Hunt refers to it in his judgment in Urbanchich. And in that particular case, the trustees of a cemetery were sued for defamation over a headstone, which was in a graveyard. And the headstone alleged that the plaintiff was illegitimate And so he communicated his unhappiness with the headstone to the trustees of the cemetery, and when they refused to remove the headstone or otherwise alter it, he sued them for defamation. And so the question for the jury was, were the trustees of the cemetery publishers of the imputation that he was, yes. Anyway, so that's my current favourite. I mean, there are a number of, you know, wonderful cases. I won't relay all of them, because some of them I do teach in my course. I don't want to be bad for business if I tell all my stories now. But that's my current favourite story, because you just go, what is this? So.
Hey, Vivian. So even though social media has become part of our daily lives, I don't think it was really in the minds of the drafters of our defamation laws, because in 2005, our main social networking platform was MySpace. So it's only recently that we've started to consume a whole range of content, including news, through social media. And now we've got this whole issue of things going viral, right?
Yeah, it's so interesting. The fact that we like now turn to social media for news is something that I guess like no one really foresaw. And I think like in my head, I feel like that happened maybe around the Trump election campaign era back in 2016. I guess it's so much easier for people to consume news through social media when they're messaging friends and like checking their friends' Facebook statuses as well. And it's so hard to shut things down on social media once they're out there, because people have the option to save, repost, share, and meme it around. So defamatory things in an article can go viral so instantly.
And so we've seen this exact problem play out in the recent decision of Vola and Nationwide News. And so this is going to be a real game changer.
Yeah, so this was a court case brought by a 23-year-old Northern Territory youth detainee who sued Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, among other news outlets, for allegedly defamatory posts made by Facebook users in 2016 and 2017 on their media pages. So it wasn't the fact that the media companies published defamatory things about him, but the fact that the Facebook users commented things like he brutally bashed a Salvo officer, that he committed a carjacking, and that he had bitten off someone's ear. And the Supreme Court agreed with him and ruled that media companies can be held liable for defamatory comments made by third parties on public social media channels.
Okay, so this has huge implications, right, for not only news sites, but anyone or any business that has a Facebook page.
Yeah, exactly. And so usually Facebook page administrators remove defamatory comments after the complaints are made. But the court relied on expert evidence here that Facebook page owners can use a software hack to prevent comments from appearing before they are cleared. And so from this decision, it was kind of implied that media companies maybe weren't choosing to use this function because they wanted to further their own commercial interests. They wanted these like red hot comments to be made in their page so that people would angry react, would like get into huge arguments. And obviously that would generate interest in their stories and, you know, generate high levels of engagement, create wider reach, drive website traffic, which ultimately leads to more advertising revenue, which is what they all want.
Exactly. And so if they're getting this big benefit, that makes sense for the Supreme Court to see that they're primary publishers of these comments. But of course, media outlets not happy with this. They were trying to argue that they were secondary publishers, which means that they wouldn't be liable if they can show that they reasonably couldn't have read through the hundreds and hundreds of comments that were popping up and all the different threads from there. The media outlets have applied for special leave to the High Court to try and appeal this decision, which will be heard later this year.
Yeah, and from this decision, I guess we can see that there's higher risks for these publication companies who probably need to now kind of like think about whether they either should disable Facebook comments on their news stories or moderate them, which obviously requires additional human intervention and will have huge cost implications for media industries, which are already kind of like in decline with the rise of social media news and everybody being a journalist.
And it definitely shows that the internet is not a defamation-free zone, which we spoke to David Rolfe about. Here's what he had to say.
You know, ranting on Facebook carries with it a whole lot of defamation risk that I wouldn't be getting around. So yes, there's no such place as a sort of, you know, defamation law free zone. The internet is certainly not one of those places. So. And for many people, I mean, if something horrible is on social media, you'd probably much rather have an effective takedown order, rather than subject yourself to defamation litigation. People sort of talk about the Streisand effect, that, you know, suing about something just amplifies the very thing that you're concerned about. So my first book and my doctoral work was on the concept of reputation and celebrity. It's not just that you draw attention to it, but once you actually sue for defamation, your defamation trial, because it's public and a part of your life story, becomes part of your reputation. So when Joe Hockey retired, you know, all the sort of end of career sort of articles referred to his then recent defamation trial. When Jeffrey Rush's biography comes to be written, you know, it's there prominently on his Wikipedia entry. Defamation proceedings, Craig McLaughlin, defamation proceedings, Jason Donovan, defamation proceedings, Andrew Ettinghausen, defamation proceedings. The fact that you sued, how the trial went, then becomes part of your reputation as well. If we think about other sorts of interests that tort law protects, there's no other interest like reputation, because, you know, we can say that everybody has a right to a reputation, but that's only true in a very formal sense, because everybody's reputation is radically subjective. No two reputations are the same. It's fascinating to me that we can sort of have a system where people are allowed to protect their reputation through law. And also, because reputation is what other people think of you, law is actually a very blunt instrument in getting people to change their minds. So, I mean, the idea that you can stop people thinking poorly of you because you sue and get a large amount of money for that, to the extent that that was possible in the past, I don't think that's possible today. I think that people might have very set ideas about people even if they win a large amount of money.
So based on the difficulties of applying these old principles to modern communication, there's been a call to simplify and update our uniform defamation laws to keep in line with the ways that we communicate online. And so I'm joined with my friend David to help talk us through what these amendments are going to look like. Hey, David.
Hey, Alana. How are you?
Yeah, good. So let's set the scene. There was a statutory review and New South Wales assented to the Defamation Amendment Act 2020 in August last year.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't taken effect yet. So there's no commencement date, mainly because New South Wales wants to wait for the other states and territories to get in line and really keep things uniform. But we can still get into what some of these amendments are and why we think that they're important.
So there's a bunch of things. It's pretty cool. There's, well, as cool as defamation law can get. Mm-hmm. There's a clarification on a cap on non-economic damages. There's a new public interest defence. There's a shiny new serious harm threshold, and there's a single publication rule.
Let's go from the top. So this cap on non-economic damages, I have a feeling this relates to Jeffrey Rush.
It does. It was a massive payday. And the reason for why it was a massive payday was because there was a cap on non-economic damages that could be circumvented by aggravated damages. There's a difference between economic and non-economic damages, right? So for all your listeners out there who don't quite know the difference, economic damages are damages that relate to your job, to a concrete, tangible amount of money you can prove you've lost. And non-economic damages is everything else from hurt feelings to really hurt feelings. Aggravated damages are essentially when the court thinks the person who's been defaming has really, really screwed up. And that's what happened in the case of Jeffrey Rush against the Daily Telegraph. Daily Telegraph said a bunch of, I won't repeat it here, but pretty unsavory things about the guy. He got $2.9 million. But the point is that it's kind of dumb when the cap is obviously a lot lower and you can just circumvent it by claiming aggravated damages. But the amendment clarifies that the cap applies even if aggravated damages are warranted.
And so that's one of the more technical amendments, but there's also some that seem quite common sense, like this new public interest defence.
Sure. So this is really, really common sense. And this is essentially, look, we want to allow our journalists to have a go at some of the most powerful people and organisations in society without them getting sued to pieces every 5 minutes. It's modelled on New Zealand and Canada, and we've essentially just copied the UK as we do. And it's specifically modelled on the Defamation Act 2013, Section 4. It's intended to be a sort of protection, a sort of shield for responsible journalism that maybe prods a bit into the affairs of the powerful or ruffles someone's feathers. That's what we want to happen. The defence requires the defendant to prove that, firstly, it's a public matter interest, whether or not the stuff you publish is actually related to the performance of the public functions or activities of the person. We don't want to be harassing public figures. We want to hold them to account. And the integrity of the sources of information. So, you know, even if you've got an anonymous source, you want to make sure that you're sourcing from reliable sources and not just asking the homeless guy down the street his opinion on Scott Morrison.
Exactly. A little bit of fact-checking and less scandalous clickbait.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it totally ties in what Vivian and I were speaking about earlier and how defamation really is like this balancing act where you obviously want to protect people's reputations, but you understand that there is this kind of public greater good idea and that, you know, we have a right to know about some things if they're in the public interest and if it's reported on accurately, which I think links in really well to the next amendment to do with the serious harm threshold.
So, obviously, most members of the public would sort of go, defamation law, oh, it's about people suing each other over the most trivial things. And that's kind of true. And that's why we do have a statutory defence of triviality. It's a bit of an effort for the defendant because what happens is you get sued and then you're the one who has to prove that the plaintiff is unlikely to establish any real harm from a defamatory publication. But that's kind of dumb, right? Like, if you get sued for, like, oh, you said this about your neighbour, about his morning habits, and that's really mean and really hurt his feelings, like, it's not something that you should have to prove is not damaging. It's something that should be, the burden of proof should be on the plaintiff. And that's exactly what the amendment does. The amendment wants to cut back on small-scale defamation litigation. Basically, what happens now is the idea of serious harm deriving from the defamation is an element of the cause of action.
It really goes to what the New South Wales Attorney General, Mark Speetman, said, in that the majority of defamation cases are probably better resolved over a cup of coffee. We just got to sit down together and talk it out, and that's probably going to get a better result than dragging something through court, which can often be embarrassing. And if you think about it, if you've been defamed, the last thing you want is more people talking about this embarrassing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably not coffee, though. You get hot coffee thrown in people's faces, maybe like a cooler liquid.
And so then I think as well, that's when our last amendment that we'll talk about comes up. So that's the single publication rule.
So the single publication rule is pretty technical. Well, okay, so there's two parts to it. One is the idea of a limitation period, which is basically how long after the crime, in this case, the tort you can sue someone for. And it runs from the first publication of an alleged defamatory material. And this is really good, you know, when we live in an era where everything is shared online. You post something online about a person, it gets shared around a lot. So instead of every time someone sharing it and that gives rise to a new cause of action, theoretically in perpetuity, it means that whenever the original act of defamation was, the limitation period runs from that, and that's it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, David. Now we'll hear from another David, David Rolfe, our expert on defamation, on why he thinks we need these reforms and particularly why they really need to be uniform.
Well, I think it's too easy to be able to sue, and so some of the reforms, like the introduction of a statutory serious harm test, is, I think, really useful. There are some instances where, you know, for instance, the seriousness of the allegation is such that you go, well, obviously there's going to be serious harm. If you make allegations that someone's a paedophile or a murderer in, you know, mass media, is it really in contest that, you know, that's likely to cause serious harm? But I think something had to be done to reinforce in the minds of practitioners that and prospective plaintiffs that, you know, there were some barriers to entry. So I think that's one of the difficulties that needs to be addressed. The other thing I think is that the common law has been very bad at protecting sort of broad-based public interest speech. I think a lot of people just assume that there's a public interest defence. Now, the problem with both of these reforms is that while I think they're useful ideas, they don't grow organically out of the development of common law principles. So judges in Australia, practitioners in Australia, haven't been acclimatised to the arguments that underpin both the serious harm threshold and the public interest offence. What's being proposed, or what's been enacted in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, yet to be enacted anywhere else, are really sort of transplants from the English legislation. And the problem of transplanting things that grew in one environment to another environment is that it may not take, or it may not take in the way that you expect. So while I think in principle both of those things are really sound developments, it's always the form of the particular provisions. And because, of course, they have to be cast in open textured terms, you know, the real test is always the application of those provisions. And so they're entirely sort of unknown quantities. What I think is really important in thinking about reforming defamation law is to realise that although we've got these general principles that apply to all forms of speech, and so we don't have special rules for defamation for different types of speech, there are different challenges depending upon who's involved. So, if you've got high-profile persons suing mass media outlet, that involves different questions than if you've got private individuals suing a mass media outlet, which is different again from corporation trying to protect their reputation against mass media, which is different again from high-profile person suing, you know, internet company, which is different again from small person suing internet company, which is different again from small person suing small person, or high-profile person suing high-profile person, or all those sort of permutations. There are different concerns, different public interests involved, different concerns about speech, different ways in which reputations are created and damaged. And that, I think, requires you to take a more holistic view about defamation law and about all the sort of levers that you might have. Because it's all very well to sort of say, let's reform the law in this way, everybody should, you know, have to prove serious harm. Well, what does that mean? I mean, if you exclude small sort of claims brought between private individuals over social media, there are social media claims brought by private individuals which are trivial or marginal, but there are also social media claims which are between private individuals which are really substantial and really awful. The idea that because it's involving private individuals on Facebook, on social media, that this is sort of not real or ephemeral harm, I think is really difficult to sort of credit. And so unless you sort of take a nuanced view about, well, you know, what are the types of plaintiffs, what are the types of defendants, what are the types of interests that are involved in these different categories, unless you have that sort of fine-grained sort of thinking about reform, you will probably engage in overbroad reforms which will do, you know, harm to the interests of some people. And I should disclose that I'm on the committee of experts advising the Attorney General about this.
How important do you think uniformity is for these upcoming reforms?
I think it's very important because the process of uniformity took over 40 years and over 30 years to secure. Whatever the flaws of the legislation that was introduced in 2005 have, and there are a number of flaws, some of which are being remedied, some of which will still be there, but whatever the flaws of that legislation, the great victory was that it brought about substantial uniformity, whereas before that period of time, we had 8 different defamation laws in Australia for a population that simply couldn't justify it. And the differences were substantial. They weren't insignificant. They would lead to different outcomes. The publication of exactly the same thing nationally might lead you to have a complete defence in one jurisdiction but be liable to pay damages in another jurisdiction. And although perhaps the reinstatement of state borders being policed might suggest otherwise, I mean, I just don't think in terms of federation really something can be defamatory in South Australia but not in New South Wales or vice versa. I mean, that sort of strikes me as very odd. Given that uniformity was incredibly sort of hard won, I think it's incredibly important that we retain uniformity, particularly because if you look at other schemes like the uniform evidence scheme or the attempt at uniform suppression of non-publication orders, none of which have been successful. They've not been adopted in all jurisdictions. In the jurisdictions where they've been adopted, they're bespoke. They're examples of notionally uniform schemes which have not been adopted. Defamation law is actually a relative success story about uniformity.
Thanks for listening. This wraps up Season 2 of Footnotes. Thank you to Gilbert and Tobin for sponsoring this season, and to our lovely producers for all of their hard work. Our production team includes Vivian Davies, Llewellyn Horgan, Vivian Lynn, Brandon Velli, David Zhu, and me, Alana Callis, and the Sol's publication director, Alison Chen. Special thanks to all of our interviewees for their time and sharing their insights this season. If there's anything you want to hear in the next season of Footnotes, get in touch via Facebook or sols.org.au. Until next time.